Texas is best known for the scorching heat, longhorn steers, and incomparable barbecue. Beyond Big Bend and big trucks, however, lies something dark, big crime. Hi y'all, my name is Vincent. Join me on Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, as we dive deep into the facts and theories of one of the 20,000 unsolved Texas cases each week. From the mysterious 1974 disappearances of Rachel Trelisa, Renee Wilson, and Julie Mosley, collectively known as the Fort Worth Missing Trio, to the Orange, Texas abduction and murder of 4-year-old Denaria Finley in 2002. To hear those and nearly 200 other stories of unsolved homicides and missing persons cases, subscribe to Gone Cold, Texas True Crime, wherever you fulfill your podcast needs.
In 1973, the New York City Police Department created a hostage negotiation team.
He's not up against a gun. He's up against a man's mind.
When you're defusing a human bomb, it's the same as when you're taking apart a real bomb. If you skip a step, it's going to blow up right in your face.
Talk to Me tells the high-stakes true story of the world's first hostage negotiation team. It changed policing forever. Talk to Me.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our look at the trial of Ralph Stokes. And welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, by my luxuriant co-host, Alice.
Luxuriant.
You're so luxuriant.
That is amazing. I wish that were
amazing.
Actually true.
Mm.
I'm not exactly sure what that means, like totally, except I don't feel luxuriant because...
Well, you and I are going to be at the beach this weekend.
Okay,
so,
well then maybe this weekend I'll feel luxuriant. Currently, right now, I like just look down. This is kind of embarrassing. I'm glad we're not doing a YouTube live tonight or anything, but that's a plug, by the way, to be a Patreon so that you can see our faces while we record some live shows. Because I looked down at my shirt and like remnants of my children's dinner are on my shirt and I didn't even know. That's a little, not even my dinner.
Yeah, I'm just wearing a t-shirt, so, yeah.
Well, I'm also wearing just a shirt. My shirt is wearing food. So the opposite of luxuriant, but I can imagine the beach this weekend where we are going to see some of our wonderful fans.
I know, I can't wait. We've got Alice and I just happened to be going to the beach. I mean, I guess it's not that coincidental, but nevertheless, we're going to be at the beach together. And so we decided, hey, if we're going to be there, we should invite some people to hang out. So we're looking forward to hanging out with folks. We'll let you guys know how that goes. Something that we plan on doing more of this year.
And for the conspiracy theorists out there, we are going with our spouses as well.
Oh, sure we are, Alice.
It's not just the two of us. Can you imagine if our spouses were listening? We're like, that's where you went that weekend?
A romantic dinner together and then a romantic hangout with, 15 of our closest friends.
No, but actually, a plug for the gallery Facebook group run by fans. We like posted on it that we were going to go to the beach, and it was literally just like feel the temperature. Who even knows? You know, I don't even know if anyone lives in that area. And there were like 150 comments within minutes. I was like, guys, you guys are the best.
Most of them were like, come to North Dakota.
Most of them were that we can't come. But the fact that people would even like want to get together is so nice.
And then they took it over and they set it up. It's great. So, I know. Yeah, we're looking forward to that.
Anyways, okay. I just plugged Patreon for our lives because can I say, I've been having a lot of fun on these live shows we're doing. We don't get to see our fans' faces because when we tried that, it like crashed the system. But it's been so, I don't know, it's invigorating. Even though I don't see them, I see their chats. And it's been just a really fun way to record a lot of our episodes.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I hope we can do it some more. All this breaking news these days, I feel like we're going to be doing a lot more. So yeah. If you want to join those and see these live recordings, I mean, you talk about getting it early. You get it as it's recorded. Join our Patreon. You also get all our episodes early and ad-free. So all of you complain about the ads. There's a very simple way out of that.
That's right.
Just a quarter. All you need is a quarter. Probably even less than that.
But I'm really glad to be coming back to Ralph Stokes today because, man, when you're looking at a historical case, something that historical in the sense that the trial happened decades ago, it really makes me think about like what my trial transcripts will look like in 40, 50 years and whether my cases will stand the test of time. So this is just an interesting kind of self-reflection as well.
There was some hilarious stuff that happened in this trial. I mean, this is a serious case, obviously, but there's some hilarious stuff that we'll talk about as we go. But yeah, this is a very old one, but it's one that's still very relevant to the people who survived and the people who have lived with this ever since, including Ralph Stokes. And we've been talking about whether or not we think this is a wrongful conviction. We spent a lot of time last time talking about the prosecutor in this case and really talking about how we think these wrongful convictions can happen and the shortcomings you can see. Now we're going to talk about the trial itself. We're going to transition into really talking about the trial. And I hope that our discussion last time will sort of set a baseline for those of you out there and that you can use that discussion to see some of the problems maybe develop in this case before we even point them out. It's an interesting case, and it's one of those cases that's a little less black and white once you dive into it than it may appear at first. And so with that, I think we've probably talked enough. Alice, do you want to talk a little bit about the theory of the case from the prosecution side?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, the prosecution has the burden, and they also are the storytellers. They have to set the stage. So, according to the prosecution, the story is that Ralph Trent Stokes had been an employee of Smoke and Joe's for about 8 months, working as a dishwasher and a short order cook. After that employment came to an end, though, Stokes decided he wanted to rob the store. And so on March 11th, there were four people at the restaurant. Mary Louise Figueroa, a 38-year-old woman who was a manager, Eugene Jefferson, a 35-year-old dishwasher, and two other men, Renard Mills and Pierre Blasingame. In addition, Peter Santangelo, a 28-year-old mailman, was making his daily rounds.
And if you see the opening statement by the prosecution, if you have an opportunity to look at it, you know, one thing you'll notice is they spend some time at the beginning when they're telling the story, really talking about the victims. In some ways, the victims don't matter at all. And I know that sounds a little weird, but their backstories, who they are, what they were doing, doesn't really matter. Because all that matters is that they were murdered. But obviously, when you're telling a story to a jury, you want the jury to immediately identify with the victims, to feel sorry for the victims, to put themselves in the victim's shoes. You can't say that explicitly. That's one thing that will get you in a lot of trouble if you tell the jury to put themselves in the victim's shoes. But you want them to do it without you asking. And one way to do that is you sort of go through who these people are, their backgrounds, how old they were, their, you know, they were married and they had kids and everything else to really flesh them out, because the victims in some way are the least present people. We all want to care about the victims. We don't see the victims. We see Ralph. He's sitting right there. The jury knows him, but they don't know the victims.
And, you know, a tactic is you kind of want to get the jury so inflamed about getting justice for the victims that they're already on your side, right? You want, this is obviously an easy case to be passionate about because there are so many victims who died, you know, including this just 28-year-old mailman who was young and really shouldn't have been there at all. It was just by accident that he came in at the wrong place at the wrong time. But you want the jury on your side. And a great way to get the jury on your side is to make them super angry about the case at hand, and they want to seek justice. Now, sometime after noon, Ralph and Donald Jackson entered the restaurant. They put the three employees in the food freezer, and then they ordered Mary, remember she's the manager who had the key to a safe, to open the safe. At this point, Ralph, for reasons that are unclear, took off his mask. Now, that's important because the prosecution says that Mary saw him and recognized Ralph and said his name out loud, except I think she said Trent, which is the name that he went by, his middle name.
And this is one of the most important and probably one of the most disputed moments in this case. There are two witnesses to this that live, Ralph and Donald Jackson, who is the accomplice. Or at least, we think Ralph was there because Donald says he was. And then there is an individual in the freezer we're going to talk about later. What exactly happened here and how exactly Mary recognized Ralph is a point of contention. The prosecution, in its opening statement, is basically saying she looked him in the face, and he'd worked there for a while. He hadn't worked there for forever, but he'd worked there for a while, and it had only been a couple months since he left. Mary would have recognized him. The weird thing about this, and we're going to talk about this more as we go through it, you came in wearing ski masks for a reason. You did that because you didn't want to be recognized. Why would you pull your mask up? That seems like a pretty dumb thing to do. Now look, I'm not saying it's impossible, because people do dumb things. And you can even imagine doing this and not thinking about it. And you almost have to imagine that's what happened. So we're hearing this from the prosecution's point of view, and they are telling us essentially what Jackson told them. So after this happens, after Mary sees Ralph and says his name, says Trent, Ralph, he then tells Jackson, after they leave, he tells Jackson what happened. And he's kind of freaking out, because he realizes he's made this terrible mistake, and now he is going to be identified. And he tells Jackson, we have to kill the witnesses. They know who I am. We have to kill the witnesses. By this point, they have put Mary back in the freezer. So she's in the freezer with the three other men who had gotten to work that day. While she's in there, she tells one of the men that it was Ralph she saw, and that she shouldn't have called out his name, and she can't believe that he is doing this. Once again, this is the story the prosecution tells. We'll talk more about this as we go through the testimony. Now, at just that time, another thing is happening. The mailman, Santangelo, is showing up. There's no indication that he knew anything was wrong. And in fact, Donald Jackson will say that at this point, he actually takes off his mask, answers the door, gets the mail, like it's an ordinary day, and that the mailman doesn't think anything of it, and he's about to leave. But for whatever reason, Ralph decides, no, he's a problem. We got to grab him. So he grabs the mailman and makes the decision to put him in the freezer, too. At this point, and the timeline's a little confused, but at some point around here, according to Donald Jackson, Ralph opens the freezer door and he shoots Mary. He shoots her right in the head. I mean, it is a shot designed to kill. He then fires a second shot, and this shot hits Eugene Jefferson in the leg. At this point, he walks up to Jefferson, he puts the gun against his head, and he pulls the trigger. This is vicious. I mean, this is a cold-blooded murder intended to get away with a robbery. Now, the two remaining men, Renard Mills and Pierre Blessingame, they're obviously terrified at this point. They are huddled on the floor. The mailman, Santangelo, he takes off running. It's a little confusing the order of things here, but at some point, Ralph attempts to shoot the other two men who were in the freezer, but his gun jams. At some point after this, he chases down Santangelo, who unfortunately has ran to a different door from the door he came in, and the door he runs to is locked. So he is a sitting duck, and Ralph walks up to him and shoots him three times, point blank, in the head. So Donald Jackson, when he's telling this story, he's basically like, all of this happened in this flurry, and he takes off. He takes off running. He's gone. He's like, I'm out of here. And he runs back to the car, jumps in the car, turns the car on, and he is fully intending to leave Trent behind. But at this point, Trent is running after him, leaving these two survivors behind, by the way. He ends up running into the door, throws himself in the car, and the two men speed off. They head to a house in South Philadelphia and divvy up the cash between them. Now, this house is not one of their houses. It's actually the house of a third person who we're going to talk about a lot. This guy is there, and they give him the firearms to hold, to get rid of. And eventually, those guns are disposed of. At this point, they do something, I don't know, I think it's kind of strange if you just killed three people. They go to get a haircut. And while they're at the barbershop getting the haircut, the 5 o'clock news is on and running a story about the murders. During the investigation into the murders, the police found some things that led them to believe that Trent was involved. They found the keys that fit the cash register. They actually found this at the house where they divvied up the cash. And they claimed to have witnesses who said that before the robbery, Ralph had told them that he was going to rob Smoking Joe's. In addition to this, they had the same caliber of ammunition that they found at Ralph's home. They found some shoes that matched some shoe prints, supposedly, at the restaurant. All these things I'm telling you will eventually be disputed. And that's what makes this case interesting is when you read the prosecution's opening statement, it feels like they have a mountain of evidence. They have really built up a good case against Ralph. But the more you look at it, the more you start to see holes.
And that's why there are two sides of a case, because what you just heard was the prosecution's story. Now, the defense comes back and argues that this case was all Donald Jackson and that Ralph wasn't even there. It makes sense, right? Donald came and gave up his friend Ralph. But they say that Ralph had an alibi. He was home with his parents. Now, the defense counsel's often criticized, but he really does do a good job in the transcript. Obviously, we weren't there. I don't think there's video in the courtroom at this time, but you can still read the transcript. And whatever is true of King, and we spent a lot of time in the first episode talking about kind of the legacy of the prosecutor, this kind of larger-than-life figure who had so many convictions in his lifetime, but after he passed away, you know, there are allegations of whether he was as good of a prosecutor as it appeared. In this transcript, what you do see is that King does definitely play fast and loose with the rules of evidence, especially hearsay. Remember, we've talked about hearsay a lot in our other shows. Brief recap for those of you who are new to the show. Hearsay is an out-of-court statement stated for the truth of the matter. So for the truth of the matter asserted, you have to be in court so that you can be cross-examined on it. Obviously, there are exceptions to hearsay. But remember, who keeps you in line for making sure that hearsay doesn't get in? It's the opposing side, because you need someone to object to hearsay. Hearsay gets in oftentimes because the other side doesn't object. But in this case, you know, I mean, King is like going left and right, hearsay, hearsay, hearsay. You know, sometimes that's a tactic. You have so much flying at the wall that you don't know what to object to. But this defense counsel, he's not letting King get away with it. He is calling King out on this.
And I think it's interesting because there's zealous advocacy and there's going too far. The obvious ways you go too far as a prosecutor are the things we've talked about before, withholding evidence and all that kind of stuff. But this is a little different. This is knowing the rules and knowing you're going beyond the rules, but sort of forcing your opponent, the defense counsel, to hold you to the rules. And knowing that if he doesn't, you're going to get away with a lot of stuff. And I think it's interesting. And I think it would be interesting to know what different people think about this. I remember my first sort of job as a prosecutor was about 5 years ago. And we had this training program and you got sort of trained on various things by more sophisticated and more experienced prosecutors. And during one of those, I asked this question. I said, look, if you know a question is objectionable, do you have any kind of ethical obligations not to ask it? Or is that on the defense counsel to object to it? And their position was they didn't ask questions that were objectionable. They thought the question was objectionable. They wouldn't ask it. And I think that's the position of a lot of people. I don't know that it's the position of most people. I think there's a lot of people who think no. If it's like clearly objection, there's just no question. But if there's any wiggle room whatsoever, that's on you, defense attorney, to raise it. Not on me, not to ask it. And King certainly was fine asking questions that were pretty clearly objectionable. The defense attorney holds him to it. One thing that's interesting is this defense counsel is competent. This is not an incompetent defense counsel, in my view. I mean, he fights King, and he goes toe-to-toe with him. But that's basically all he can do. He does not recognize some of the holes in the prosecution's case. And because he doesn't recognize them, he doesn't exploit them. That's not being incompetent. You know, you really want to have a really good or great lawyer when you're on trial for your life, but there aren't many of those. And so a lot of times you get a decent lawyer, and this is a decent lawyer. Unfortunately for Ralph, this case looks simple, but is actually complex. This defense attorney was never going to be able to see the complexity. So all he really got was a competent lawyer who held the prosecution to the rules, forced them to prove their case, but was never really going to be able to overcome any of that proof.
Yeah, that's right. And another thing on optics for the courtroom, just courtroom dynamics, another tactic is for one side to do so many objectionable things and recognizing that the jury may get tired of hearing opposing counsel say objection, objection, objection. So you have to be a little bit more picky and choosy as to what you object to, because even though it's not the objecting counsel's fault, that may become, you know, wearisome on the jury to keep hearing one counsel say objection and thinking that they're the ones who are kind of fighting. Anyways, those are all really great points, Brett. And it's interesting to see King's tactic here. Let's turn specifically to the robbery. Some aspects of the crime indicate that the person who committed it had some familiarity with the business. We've already talked about this in the first episode. We knew that the restaurant opened at 3, meaning not for lunch, and the robbers knew that it would be sparsely populated at lunchtime, which is not something you necessarily would know about a restaurant. I think it's a good bet that a restaurant may be open at lunchtime, but not in this case. These people seem to have known that they would be able to have a small population there that they could control easily, which was the case. Moreover, only 3 people knew the code to the safe, of which Mary was one. And the robbers went straight to Mary to open the safe, indicating that they knew she had the information they needed and they didn't need to bumble around and figure out who had access to the safe.
Now, obviously, this isn't necessarily a slam dunk piece of evidence against Ralph. It's not as if he's the only person who ever worked at this restaurant. This restaurant, like a lot of restaurants, had a lot of people coming and going, had a lot of former employees, and had a lot of current employees, any of whom could have been involved in the robbery. And this is an example of a circumstantial piece of evidence that you don't throw it out. I mean, this is the thing. When people look at circumstantial evidence, I feel like someone is already writing this comment on YouTube that, well, just because he knew doesn't mean it was him. It could have been anybody. So therefore, this doesn't even matter. That's not true. It matters because Ralph is in that category of people who would know. So it is evidence that he is more likely to have been involved in the crime. Does it prove it? Of course not. It has to be paired with a whole bunch of other stuff to make you think he's involved with the crime. But the fact that they weren't bumbling around, that they weren't trying to figure out who they needed to talk to, that they went straight to Mary tells you there probably is a limited universe of people who could have done this, and Ralph is one of those people.
And I also wonder, I mean, Mary, obviously, she was the only woman of the 4 of them. I'm just pointing out reasons that maybe kind of by accident they would have gone to her. So she would have stood out, just the fact that she was the only woman. She was older than the other people, I think. You know, it could have just been like, I don't know, either the woman's in charge or she's someone different and they went for her. So again, like Brett said, it's not a slam dunk that just because they went straight to Mary, that they necessarily even knew that she was one of 3 people who knew the code to the safe.
So let's talk about Mary's husband, George. So George is sort of a tragic figure. I mean, he is a tragic figure in this case. And this is something that haunts him to this day. And it's hard to imagine going through what he went through. He was part owner of the restaurant. He was Mary's husband. So Mary is one of the managers. He's one of the part owners. He's also a manager. He shows up a little bit later in the day, and he actually found Mary dead when he went to open the restaurant. And it was he who alerted the police. He would testify in this trial, and that he would essentially say when he showed up at the restaurant, there were still two men alive. We've talked about them before. The most important one is Mills. So Mills tells him that it was Trent who did this. And the reason he knew it was Trent was because Mary recognized Trent and told him it was Trent in the freezer. Mills knew Trent. In fact, Trent had brought him to the restaurant to apply for a job. We're going to spend a lot of time on Mills as we talk more and more about this case. His testimony is absolutely critical in this case because he is the one who relays what Mary said. So the only reason we know what Mary said, obviously, is because of Mills. This actually brings in some interesting hearsay issues that we're also going to talk about. But Mills is really important, and this initial statement he makes to George is really important. And it is the thing that sets the police on to Ralph. So after George testifies, there's also some detectives who testify extensively about some of the evidence they found. One detective testifies that he noticed sneaker prints in the kitchen area, specifically in this freezer. So we talked about these gunshots. These gunshots not only hit people, but they were gunshots that didn't hit anyone. And in fact, one of the gunshots apparently punctured a bottle of barbecue sauce. So there was barbecue sauce on the floor, there was blood on the floor, and the police believed that these prints were in a combination of that barbecue sauce and blood. Now, there is an interesting twist in this case. Ordinarily, murders, obviously, are state crimes. They're investigated by the state police unless there's something really sophisticated or unusual about it. Ordinarily, you know, federal government officials won't be involved. Not always the case. People always get this wrong and think the FBI has no jurisdiction over murders. If you need the FBI's help, you can ask. And if they have the capacity and the case is important enough, they will help you. We've seen that in the Moscow murders. For instance, Delphi, these complicated cases, the FBI will often help.
And by the way, the reason the FBI helps is it's jurisdiction that matters. The FBI may not have jurisdiction to prosecute that case. Obviously, FBI is not the one prosecuting case. They're the investigators who bring it to the prosecutors. So the feds may not have jurisdiction to prosecute something federally, but it doesn't prevent the federal investigators to help state and locals with a state and local crime.
Right. There's absolutely nothing that prevents the FBI from investigating a case if they're asked to do so by the local police. They don't have the power just to muscle their way in to a purely local matter and say, sorry, police, we're taking over. They can't do that, but if asked, they can help. And that's why one of the most important things that can happen early on in a case is a local jurisdiction asking the FBI for help. It's a very important thing to do in complicated cases. It's often a sign that the case is probably going to go badly if they don't do that, because that shows pride and everything else is more important than solving the case, but they can help. Here, though, we have an interesting angle. There was a mailman, and he was murdered, and that makes this case a federal case. It is a federal crime to kill a federal official in pursuit of their duties, and the Postal Service takes it pretty seriously when you kill one of their mailmen. Now, the Postal Service allowed the local DAs to prosecute this case, but they helped a lot. And in fact, they were doing a lot of the investigation. One of the people involved was Postal Inspector Douglas Oswalt. And if you look at the file, you'll see a lot of his reports are in that. He gets called to the stand. And he actually helped to execute the search warrant at Ralph's home. He had been one of the investigators that noticed the shoe prints at the restaurant. So when he goes to Ralph's home, he is looking for those shoes. And when he conducts a search of Ralph's home, what does he find? He finds a pair of Adidas sneakers soaking in a plastic tub of water. According to him, the sneakers had some sort of reddish stains on them, and Oswalt thought that the stains were similar to what he observed in the footprints at the restaurant. He said that they weren't just soaking in water, that the water actually had the odor of Clorox. So this was an effort to clean these shoes. At the same time that he's seizing these shoes and thinking this is going to be a big piece of evidence, he's also seizing a blue, trimmed in red ski suit. The survivors had described the one that the robbers were wearing as similar, though they described it as a blue tracksuit. So this is an interesting thing. And sort of an interesting thing about evidence. The police seized this. There's no way to know for certain whether this is related to the crime. We can't say for sure that this is what the robbers were wearing. But nevertheless, it's going to come in this trial, and the two sides are going to argue about it. So the prosecution is going to present it as this is similar to what the eyewitnesses were saying. And essentially, the prosecution, without ever making it explicit, is tapping into the idea that eyewitnesses get things wrong. That they may describe something, and the more general the description, probably the more accurate it is. So here, you're describing a ski suit as blue. Nobody mentions that it's trimmed in red. And they describe it more as a track suit than a ski suit. But nevertheless, the prosecution thinks this is close enough that they can introduce it. And because it is pretty close, it's allowed to come in. And then the defense on cross-examination goes through all the discrepancies. The fact that no witness said it was trimmed in red. The fact that the witnesses described it more as a track suit than a ski suit. And these are the kind of things that get argued about at trial. In addition to this, the police found some gloves that were similar to the ones used in the robbery. We talked about this last time. This included some gloves that had the index fingers cut off of them. Now, these were not the same gloves that were used. That's what's interesting, once again, about this case. They know these are not the gloves. They don't match the description. Other than the fact the index finger is cut off. So what they tried to do is to show that they were cut in the same way, maybe with the same instrument. So they just want to say, look, then this is goes back to circumstantial evidence. There might be a lot of people that have gloves, a lot of people who cut the index finger off for whatever reason. Ralph is in that universe. So now you've got Ralph, who's in the universe of people who have gloves with the finger cut off, who's in the universe of people who worked at the restaurant, is in the universe of people who wear blue tracksuits, and is in the universe of people who have shoes that have some sort of reddish-brown thing on them. And the prosecution is hoping when you combine all that together, you're like, what are the chances, right? That all these things are just coincidences? No, this is the person who was involved. In addition to this, the police also find 38 caliber ammo. This is the same caliber of ammo as used in the murder. Once again, very popular round of ammunition, so it's not as if this is a slam dunk. But you add it into, now Ralph is also in the category of people who have access to ammunition that is the same kind as used in the murder. And in fact, the police found spent shells indicating that at some point, someone in the home had actually fired a gun with that ammunition. So this is the sort of the tapestry of the mosaic, as we've described it before, of circumstantial evidence that the police are trying to put together to show that Ralph is the one who committed this crime.
And by the way, I know this may sound like, oh, wait a second, why are they seizing all these things that don't seem to be directly on point? I haven't seen the search warrant affidavit, but this is kind of typical police work. You, of course, hope to find things in your search warrant, and you're obviously showing the judge that you have probable cause to go in and seek, you know, instruments of or fruits of the crime. But oftentimes when you're in there, you take what you think might help tell a story, especially in the totality. And so nothing about this search warrant gives me heartburn, not having seen the affidavit, of course. But these could all, you know, you don't know exactly what kind of suit or tracksuit or whatnot that people are describing. And so you may be looking at what you have. You may be taking it to see what size he's wearing, to see if it could be in the realm of what he's having. The gloves thing, especially, I've seen law enforcement do, where you don't necessarily expect to find the actual gloves that someone used in committing it because you think they may have disposed of it. But if there's some similarity you can show, that's not just mass produced. Everyone would have something like this. You can show kind of by analogy, this is like what we've seen the perpetrator where.
And you'll have defense attorneys who will object to this kind of stuff because they'll say, look, They can't show it's actually the gloves. They can't show it's actually the tracksuit. The problem is the relevant standard is what you're really saying. You're basically saying this is not relevant because they can't show it actually was used in the crime. So therefore, this is extraneous evidence. It's going to confuse the jury. They can't introduce it. But the bar for relevance, very low, very low. Basically the lowest bar in the rules of evidence. It's something that has a tendency to prove or to show a fact is more likely. That's all it has to do. A tendency to show a fact is more likely. So here, take the gloves, for instance. The fact that he owns gloves with the trigger finger cut off has a tendency to show that it's more likely that he was the one wearing gloves with the trigger finger cut off. Doesn't have to show it that much. All it has to do is some tendency. And like I said earlier, putting him in the universe of people who have gloves like that, that's probably enough. That's probably enough to be relevant evidence that's going to come in at trial.
Right. That wasn't the only search warrant, because officers also executed a warrant at the apartment of Donald Jackson's girlfriend, Twinkles. They found not only property of Donald Jackson, but Ralph's wallet with his voter ID card and Social Security card in it. So that's interesting, because what that shows is that Donald Jackson and Ralph Stokes were together at some point, likely, or ties them together. Again, remember, we're kind of telling the totality of the circumstances. If Donald Jackson were just spouting off about this Ralph guy who committed this crime with him, but there was no way to show that they actually interacted with each other, that they spent time together, were close enough to commit a crime together, to come, you know, meeting of the minds to commit this robbery, then murder together, then that would be a harder story to tell. But if Donald's girlfriend has something as precious, I guess, as, you know, a voter ID card and Social Security card of Ralph's, you would think that shows that Ralph and Donald are together a lot.
Yeah, and I think this is a really interesting piece of evidence, because the closer you can tie Ralph to Donald Jackson, the better. And the defense attempts to separate the two, to say, look, they didn't know each other very well, they weren't that close, they didn't hang out, and all that's good, but you come back to this very weird fact that Donald Jackson somehow has this wallet. Ralph's going to try and say later on that it was an old wallet, and I think it's something like he let Donald borrow a jacket and the wallet was in the jacket, but whatever the case is, why ever he had it, it at least shows some connection between the two of them. I don't think anybody argues that Donald Jackson robbed him at some point and stole his wallet. That didn't happen. So the fact that there's some connection between them, once again, it's another piece of circumstantial evidence that strengthens this mosaic that shows, as Alice said, these are not two random people. They have a connection, and that connection is important.
And an interesting thing, as you can, you know, if you've listened to our podcast long enough, you're probably already debating the different sides of this as we're talking about it. So if the defense is saying that this is an old wallet, would you leave your Social Security card in your old wallet? You know, that seems to be a pretty important piece of identification that you wouldn't just not care about or look for if it indeed was an old wallet. If it had no forms of identification and maybe just had some business cards and, you know, old business cards you collected, receipts, maybe a little bit of cash, that might make sense that it's an old wallet. But you can see how it's kind of, you know, there's arguments to be made as to whether, in fact, this was an old wallet. And that's exactly what the lawyers are doing back and forth. But what we have here, again, is something pretty weighty that belongs to Ralph over at not just Donald's house, but Donald's girlfriend's house. Let's talk about Joseph Bell. Bell was a barber in Philadelphia. And remember, we talked about the haircuts that Ralph and Donald went to get after the murders. So the day of the murders, apparently based on the prosecution story, Ralph and Donald go divvy up the money. Then for whatever reason, later that afternoon, they come into the barbershop where Bell is to get their haircut. And we know that while they're there, there's a news story about the murders that day. And by the way, I don't think this is a haircut. Some of you may be thinking, well, you change your appearance, you know, to run from the law when you commit something like murder. So I don't think they're getting their hair cut like they had, you know, long hair and they're shaving it all off, because you can honestly do that at home. And we often see like massive changes in, say, facial hair or head hair to be something that someone does at home. Like they'll shave off all their hair or they'll shave off their beard. But here it's like a pretty typical trip to the barber to maintain their current haircuts.
And I think if it happened, the reason it happened was normalcy. It was, we're just going about our day. Normal day, got a haircut, no big deal. Would somebody who just murdered three people go get a haircut with their accomplice? Of course not, right? I mean, this is the thing that I feel like people forget sometimes. We talked about this some with Scott Peterson. When you murder people, particularly when you plan on murdering people, usually you're trying to get away with it. And when you're trying to get away with it, you're going to build in things into your day and into what you do and how you act to try and convince people you didn't do it.
And to have alibis, right? To have people like, oh, I talked to them that day. I saw them that day. They didn't have cuts on their hand. They didn't look like they'd been frazzled. They weren't stressed out. We've all had friends who are like, man, I've had a terrible day. You know, I got into a car accident today. Like, I can't hang out tonight. I'm just shaken. You know, nothing like that. They were totally normal. They always come in on Tuesdays or whatever day of the week it is. And we shoot the breeze for 2 hours at the barbershop. And this was just another one of those days.
And remember, when we talked about the Kyron Horman case, one of the things we thought was interesting was that Terry was so everywhere. And everybody was seeing her. And she was talking to everybody. And being very effusive. And making sure nobody would forget her, right? And this is the kind of thing that makes you wonder, are they trying to build in that alibi, like Alice is saying? And this is the case. Are they trying to build in normalcy? Now, what's going to be interesting about this as we continue to talk about it. So Bell testifies that Ralph came in. He identifies him from the stand. This is always an important moment, these kind of things, when you ask, do you see the man that you cut his hair that day? Do you see him in the courtroom? And they say yes. And you ask them to point him out. And they say he's sitting over there at the table wearing, you know, a blue suit and red tie and a white shirt or whatever. And then you let the record reflect that he identified the defendant. And that's an important thing because he's identifying him as being the person there. That happens in this case. However, it is not the case that Bale knew Ralph all that well. So Ralph, his position is he didn't do this. He didn't go to the barber. And it's going to become sort of a point of contention about whether or not this was actually Ralph with Donald Jackson or not. As we go through this, there is a third person who is going to emerge in this story, who is going to be very important, and who may or may not have been someone that people might have could have confused for Ralph. And we're going to talk about that more. But obviously, this is a powerful moment for the prosecution because, once again, they're putting Donald and Ralph together on the day of the murders, very shortly after it happened. Then the prosecution puts on Donald Blackson. He is also going to be an important witness for the prosecution. According to Blackson, he had known Ralph since elementary school. And on March 10th, before the murders, Ralph had told him that he was going to rob Smokin' Joe's. Blackson said that Ralph told him he would have asked for his help, but he already had someone else. And so this obviously is Donald Jackson. So Ralph, he's planning this. And before it even happens, you have a witness who says he's going to do it. This seems like a pretty important moment. But on cross, this gets really weird. So the defense is able to trip Blackson up, and he backs off what exactly Ralph said to him. So the prosecution side, he's saying basically exactly what you would think the prosecution would want to hear. That Ralph just came out and said, yeah, I'm going to rob the place. But on cross, he said he told him he was going to get paid from Smokin' Joe's. Now, here's the thing. Ralph had worked at Smokin' Joe's, and he had left, and it's unclear whether he had ever actually gotten his last paycheck or not. So that language could mean one or two things. And this is where what we talked about last time comes in, and where people start to point to the prosecution. What did Donald Blackson actually hear? Did he hear that he was going to rob the place, which is really important, or did he hear something far less significant? So the defense is trying to say basically the prosecution, they coached him. They coached him to say this thing that is much better for them, but in fact, he said this other thing. Now, what's interesting about this is on redirect. So the way this goes, you direct a witness, he gets crossed. You then have the option as a prosecution to do redirect, where you get up and you can ask more questions of your witness that are relevant to whatever the defense asked. So if the defense didn't go into it, you can't go into it on redirect. But if they did, you can go into it. And in this case, they want to read Blackson's original statement into the record as a prior consistent statement. So basically, get a little hearsay here. So basically, Blackson had said on the stand, he said he was going to rob the place. On cross-examination, the defense challenges that and says, didn't he really say this other thing? And in doing so, implies that Blackson has changed his statement. This is that the statement he gave on direct is a new thing that he's made up. So you as the prosecution can now do something you couldn't normally do. Ordinarily, what a witness tells a police officer is classic hearsay. It's a statement made outside of court. You want to offer for the truth of the matter asserted. You can't do it. They got to get on that stand and say it again in front of the jury. You can't just read their statement to the police into the record. But there is a rule, an exception to hearsay, Rule 801 D1B, if you really care, that allows you to read a prior consistent statement into the record when the witness is being challenged and when someone is saying, isn't it true that you just recently made this up because prosecution, they got you to say this? And in fact, the statement originally was much closer in time to the murder. It's much more fulsome. It is better for the prosecution. It still doesn't come out as clearly as this initial statement did, but it does sound worse for Ralph. So this was a win for the prosecution that they could get that statement in. However, then there's recross.
Just by the way, each of the things that Brett has described happening, like the initial statement of he said he was going to rob the place and then cross, he just said he got paid. And then he reads the prior. I mean, each of these events are like shocking moments in court, right? Like if we were watching it and eating popcorn, we could say, oh no, and like spill all our popcorn. This is as exciting as it gets as lawyers.
And I'll say this, there was a way to attack Donald Blackson. We're going to talk about it later. That would have been much more effective than what the defense does. The defense kind of walks into this by challenging him the way that they do. And it's a good challenge because Blackson did say the get paid thing. It's a good challenge, but it really is opening the door to read the statement in. And the prosecution, they run through that door. I mean, they read the entire statement. They don't limit it to the narrow sections of it that they probably should have. They get the whole statement in. But anyways, he get the whole statement in, but on recross, so now the defense attorney is able to get up and cross-examine on whatever the prosecution redirected on. So they attack the initial statement, and they get Blackson to admit that he didn't really remember anything anymore, and that at the time, he had been high as a kite. He had been smoking marijuana all day when he gave this initial statement. So they're basically trying to undermine the initial statement and say, look, frankly, you didn't even know what you're talking about when you gave the initial statement. You can't confirm that statement. Now, this is not something that the jury should take very seriously. And trials are really like this. I mean, there are so many witnesses that you walk away from and you're just not really sure who won. You're happy that you got the information in, but you're just not sure whether you pulled off what you wanted to.
And honestly, when you have vigorous advocacy on both sides, many of the witnesses are like this, where there's a lot of information that comes out on both sides. And that's exactly why you have a jury. Because what you're hoping, if something's bad for you, is you get enough of information on the table that you get someone to say, I don't know, there's just so much out there. If, you know, that bad information is kind of discounted with all this other noise. And the noise being that he was high as a kite, that he has, you know, different things he's saying even on the stand and when he talked to the police earlier. In fact, it's really hard to get a witness who doesn't have this much baggage. So this is advocacy at work.
So the prosecution, I mean, they're really pounding Ralph now. I mean, they're just lining up good witnesses against him. And the next one is a big one. It's Mills. Mills is the survivor who testifies. The other gentleman who survived Blessing Game, he actually doesn't testify. And the reason that's given for that is that he'd essentially had a nervous breakdown because of the robbery and was just in no condition to testify. He just couldn't testify. This has led to a lot of speculation by people who think that this trial was rigged, that if Blessingame had testified, he would have said something very different and very bad for the prosecution. We can't say that now. I don't think Mr. Blessingame is still with us, but it honestly isn't that surprising to me that if you'd seen a couple people shot, you'd been shot at, you thought you were going to die, that you'd have a nervous breakdown. So I'm not willing to go this is some conspiracy by the prosecution. It may just be that he just wasn't able to do it because of what happened to him. But Mills was. Mills was, and he testified after Blackson. And Mills said that, you know, he'd been working that day, they'd been getting the restaurant ready to open when two men with masks came in through the back door. They had ordered Mills to do what they said or he'd be shot. He was then directed into the walk-in freezer with another employer, Pierre Blessingame. They were joined shortly thereafter by Eugene Jefferson, who was an older man who was the dishwasher. The next time the door opened, it was to put Mary Figueroa inside. So, as we said earlier, they identify Mary very quickly as someone they want. There are four people there. They take three of them. They put them in the freezer. They take Mary. They take her to the office. So she's coming in now after she's been in the office, after she's opened that safe. And she says to Mills, or this is what Mills says she said on the stand, "That was Trent. I don't believe it was him. I don't believe he would do anything like this." So essentially she is just expressing shock and surprise that he would be involved in anything like this. And obviously, this is a really powerful moment. Just real quick, because we've talked about hearsay before. What is hearsay? Hearsay is an out-of-court statement made for the truth of the matter asserted. We are bringing Mary's statement in that she said that it was Trent. Obviously, that's for the truth of the matter asserted that it was Trent. Mary is not there. She is dead. So there has to be an exception to bring this in. This is not a dying declaration because Mary's not, she hadn't been shot yet. If she had been shot and she was laying on the ground and she said, "It was Trent," that would be a dying declaration. That's not what we have here. The way they get this in is through an excited utterance or a present sense impression. Basically, Mary, in the excitement of the robbery, is recounting what she just saw. And because of that, we think that what people say in an excited state, they haven't had a moment to think about fabricating anything. Whatever they say is probably true. And because it has that truthful quality, we're going to allow it to come in as an exception hearsay. So that's why Mills can testify to what Mary said. The prosecution had earlier attempted to get this statement in through an officer. It did not come in then because it was double hearsay. It was what Mary said to Mills and then what Mills said to the officer. Mary's statement is subject to a hearsay exception and can come in. But in order for the officer to testify, Mills' statement also has to be subject to a hearsay exception, and it wasn't. So the officer couldn't say what Mary said. They had to put Mills on the stand, and then he could relay what he heard her say.
And that's really interesting, by the way. That's not uncommon where when you map out your trial witnesses and your trial strategy, you're trying to figure out who of your witnesses are going to get in the most important statements, pieces of evidence, documentary or otherwise. And they may have tried to get it in through the police just, you know, for strategy to make sure that you had multiple people to get it in. But they likely were not going to get it in through the police. And they probably knew that, which is why they had to put up Mills.
And you can see why you have hearsay exceptions. This is obviously a statement that should come in. And if you didn't have a hearsay exception, it wouldn't come in. So you want this statement to come in. But you can also see why hearsay is so dangerous. All we have is Mills and what Mills says, she said. Now, Mills is subject to cross-examination, and that's great, but we can never really prove what Mary said because she's not with us. So this very damning statement is coming in the way Mills is presenting it, and the jury, you know, just has to take it for what it's worth. And the way Mills puts the statement, this time at least, very clear. Trent's the one who did it. Mills also says that the men were wearing blue jumpsuits and wearing red ski masks. He says that he recognizes Ralph. Now, how does he recognize him? He says he recognizes his eyes, which I'm sorry, I find that weird. I mean, he had worked with Ralph before. He knew Ralph. Ralph had gotten him hired, and he said he knew his eyes. I don't know. I'm curious what people think about whether or not you could recognize somebody who's wearing a ski mask based solely on their eyes. I just, I don't know.
And you would also understand why he would say that, because that's all that's really exposed. You know, you can't say like, oh, he's wearing gloves. He's wearing the track suit or the whole body covering. There aren't a lot of pieces for Mills to grasp onto other than the eyes.
And he gets asked, how'd you recognize the eyes? And he has no answer for that. Like, there's no like, oh, well, you know, they were a unique shape, or Ralph has a little like speck in his eye and it's obvious, or one eye is green and one eye is blue or whatever. I mean, he has no real description, but he is adamant that he recognized his eyes. And so this all seems pretty good for the prosecution, but there are a couple of things that happen that are not. The first is he's shown the ski suit. He's shown the ski mask that recovered from Ralph's home. And he says, that's not what they were wearing. So it's great that you got those things that are kind of close, but that is not what they're wearing. He is adamant about that, which is interesting for a couple reasons. Number one, if Mills was truly being coached to say the right thing, you'd think he would say, oh yeah, that was it. Definitely wearing that. But he doesn't do that. And so to at least some extent, his testimony is not perfect for the prosecution. But far worse for the prosecution is the 911 call. So Mills is on the 911 call. The defense plays the 911 call. And it's really interesting because Mills basically doesn't know anything when he's on the 911 call. So this is right after the murders. He's asked if he knows who it was. He said he doesn't know who it was. He tells the 911 operator he doesn't even know if the robbers were white or black. So it's really interesting that now on the stand he's saying, oh, I recognized him by his eyes. But when he's on the phone with the 911 operator right after it happened, and supposedly right after Mary has told him it was Trent, he's like, I have no idea who they are and can't even tell you their race. That's incongruous. It may be explained by the intensity of the moment and adrenaline and everything else, but certainly it puts a damper on Mills' testimony and everything that he's saying about how clear it was that it was Ralph in the room and not someone else.
And, you know, it's even more powerful when you hear the 911 call, because it's one thing to say someone's so shocked that they don't recount, you know, this excited utterance where a woman who has been shot in front of you, he said the name of who she thought this was, or not thought, like knew, she was so sure of it, and that, you know, you recognize some features of this person. Because in the 911 call, he literally is like, I don't even know if these people were white or black. If that is the case and everything's covered up where you don't even know their race, it seems strange that you could be able to see their eyes and see them and still not know the kind of the race and be so committed to being able to identify Ralph on the stand.
And this is such an important thing, whether Mills is accurate or not. We're going to come back to it. We're going to talk more about Mills, more about this 911 call. This is bad testimony for Ralph, obviously, but the defense has scored some points, and they score some more points on clothes because they point out a obvious inconsistency with the story. The story is that Ralph is so concerned about the fact that Mary recognized him that he's going to kill everybody. And to the extent that he shoots this mailman who don't even know him, never seen him before, but he leaves Mills alive. And Mills was the person who knew him better than anybody. Mills was the person that he had known before any of them even worked at Smokin' Joe's. And so the fact that he kills these other people and doesn't kill Mills, not definitive, because once again, crimes are messy and the gun jammed. He certainly was planning on killing everybody. Doesn't necessarily mean he's going to kill Mills first, but the fact that he doesn't kill Mills and he leaves him alive is at least something that is off enough that the defense feels like we can make this point and score some points with it.
We've talked about several witnesses and they've been fascinating. Let's turn to Gavin Coates, because Coates testified that he had known Ralph for quite some time and that sometime before the robbery, Ralph asked him if anyone had ever robbed Smokin' Joe's. Coates also said that he'd seen Ralph with a revolver similar to the one used in the robbery. Okay. Note, neither of those statements that he says necessarily tie Ralph to this robbery. But again, the prosecution's trying to get all this out there so there's an entire story around Ralph, right? Why would Ralph want to know? That's a weird thing to ask if Smoke and Joe's ever been robbed. Or it could be innocuous. But they're trying to show that he's trying to get information in advance of his own robbery. And then talking about the revolver being the same as the one being used, he isn't saying that he saw Ralph with the same revolver that day or that Ralph had shown him the revolver and that this was what he planned to use. So the prosecution is relying on the jury to draw a lot of inferences from these statements. But in conjunction with all the other evidence, they're hoping it fills out a story. But that's why it's really important to have jurors who are willing to kind of critically think and not jump to conclusions or connect the dots that one side or the other is putting in front of you, making you try to connect those dots.
Yeah. And I feel like as we sort of reach the end of this episode, things are looking grim for Ralph. And they're only going to get grimmer because there are more witnesses. And the next witness is one of the most important, Donald Jackson, the accomplice. We are going to talk more about Donald Jackson. We're going to talk a lot about Donald Jackson in the next episode. As I said at the beginning of our discussion of this case, avoid anchoring bias. We're giving you the prosecution's case because it's the case that came first. And there's a lot of things that are really strong about the prosecution's case. But I promise you, as we look at this, and as we talk about this more, there will come a point where a lot of these seemingly ironclad facts we've been giving you will begin to show cracks. And I am really intrigued to see what people think at the end, because there is another side to this story. And I want all of you to try and keep an open mind until we've told both those sides. We're going to talk more about this next week, but I'm sure you already have thoughts. Shoot us an email at prosecutorspod@gmail.com, at prosecutorspod on all your social media. Hello to those of you following this on YouTube. YouTube's growing every day. We're getting more and more people on YouTube, so that's always fun. And hello to those of you getting this episode early and ad-free on Patreon. Well, Alice, is there anything else you want to add before we sign off for tonight?
Whew. All trials are fun, I'm going to say, whether they happened 40 years ago or today. I get a rush reading these transcripts. So I hope you guys are as well. And we hope you come back because there's still a lot to come. And if you're not sure what to think yet, then come on back because there is still a lot more for you to consider.
Yeah, you can't give up on this case till we get, if the shoes don't fit, you must have quit. So stick with us on this one. Okay, guys, we'll be back next week with more of this case. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors.
On March 11th, there were four people at the restaurant. Mary Louise Figuera? How do you say that?
Figuera?
I feel like that's like not an uncommon name.
Am I missing a letter there? Because I feel like this wasn't that
last time.
Hold on. Let me back up, because we said the name of her husband earlier.
No, Figueroa.
be interesting, people's reaction to this. I'm always interested when we do cases that people don't know.
Yeah.
Like, are people going to stick with it? Uh-huh. Or are they going to be like, I only want to hear about Adnan? You know what I mean? Like, it'll be interesting to see.
I mean, maybe the latter, but it's an interesting case.
No, we'll do Adnan later.
Don't tell them yet.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.